All right, my name is Amber Duke, and I'm interviewing Ira Grouper on Tuesday, June 14th, 2011, at his home on Bonnycastle Avenue in Louisville. So, Ira, thank you
thank
for doing
you.
This interview.
Happy to do it.
And just so that we have it on record, I did give you a chance to look over and sign the consent form, and you are okay with it?
You threatened me, and I shall sign it. No, you didn't give it to me. I looked it over, and I'm happy to sign it.
Great. Can you say and spell your name for me?
My name is Ira Grouper. I-R-A-G-R-U-P, like in Peter, P like in Peter, E-R.
Okay, great. So we're going to start out with first some just biographical questions.
Sure.
So tell me when and where you were born.
I was born on January 4th, 1944, in Brooklyn, New York, New York City.
All right. And then I know that there's a longer story that we'll get into later associated with this, but tell me just briefly how you ended up here in Louisville.
I was a civil rights worker in Mississippi and Georgia during the civil rights movement. And I met Ann and Carl Braden. Don't ask me where, but it was somewhere in the Deep South at some meeting. And we got to know each other. We became friends. And they had a fundraising office. Their organization, Southern Conference Educational Fund, had a fundraising office in New York City. And I was living in New York City, and I was working as a salesman. And I was an outside salesman. I made pretty good money. It was not door-to-door. And they usually say that the dirty movie houses are filled with salesmen in the afternoon who met their quota. But instead of me going to the dirty movie houses, I would volunteer for different organizations, one of which was the SCEF fundraising office. And Carl and Ann came through New York many, many times to fundraise, and we got to know each other pretty well. Again, it started in the Deep South. And they called me in, it was sometime in 1968 to ask me if I was interested in coming south again and working for SCEF, that they would train me to run the press operation. They had two offset presses, and they had a dark room. They teach me layout and paste up and all that. And at that time, I was being interviewed for a project for the United Electrical Workers Union, the UE, organizing a big project in, where was it? I want to say Tampa, but I'm not positive. They were organizing a big Westinghouse plant. They were building these huge turbines, so big that they couldn't offload them on a boxcar. They had to put them on a flatbed barge and ship them into the Gulf of Mexico. And I didn't think I was going to get that job. I got to around the quarterfinals, but I was an experienced union organizer, but I didn't have the supervisory experience, and I have a disability. I don't drive a car, so I didn't think I was going to get the job. And that was big money. And Carl and offered me a job for $115 a month, which even at that time was not hardly. And I remember after we head off, and anyhow, so I accepted the job, and I was engaged. We got married, and both my wife, the then wife, and I moved to Louisville. We ran the printing operation for a while, but that's what brought me to Louisville, and I've been here ever since.
And was that in 1968?
It was New Year's Day, 1969, the beginning, the first day of 1969 is when I moved to Louisville. But I was hired around, I don't know, October, November.
Okay.
Before that.
Can you tell me a little bit about your educational background?
Graduated high school in New York. My intention was to get a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD in 17th century English literature, because I grew up in a city housing project. We had no money. And what my brother and I didn't work for, we didn't have. I never missed a meal. I don't want to plead poverty, but that's what it was. And my mother said, Mom always said that education is the thing. Anyhow, the civil rights movement came along, and I said, this is not my cup of tea. That's not what I said. I said, fuck this shit. I don't need it. I was not an anti-intellectual, so I took a few courses in college, but I'm basically a high school graduate.
Okay. And tell me a little bit about, tell me about your family. How many brothers and sisters?
Oh, and the other thing I should say is, I'm, notwithstanding the fact that I don't have a college degree, I consider myself an autodidact, somebody who's self-educated. And in fact, I teach at a university now, so I'm doing at least minimal. I have one brother, 5 years younger than me, no sisters.
Okay. How did you first learn about race and racism?
growing up in New York, particularly in a project, you learn about race and racism on the streets. There was a lot of tension. I was in fights, actually. I remember some African-American kids stole my brother's cowboy hat, and I was in a fight to get it back. And even though it was just a fight between kids, there's always the racial element. I remember seeing Rosa Parks on television in 56. I was born in 44, so I was 11 or 12 years old at the time. And it made a huge impression upon me. I understood, began to understand a little bit about race, because my mother was not a stone racist. She didn't want black people being bitten by police dogs in Birmingham. But she was not a progressive person at all. My father was an anti-racist. He was not an activist the way you and I are, Amber. But he was a very decent man. And I learned about it through him. I guess that was the genesis of that.
Okay. Can you describe any people who inspired you when you were growing up? You mentioned Rosa Parks. Are there other folks?
As far as historical readings, before I tell individual persons, I became politicized when I was about 13 years old, 12 or 13. And I should tell you, I come from an Orthodox Jewish background, what you would call the Holy Rollers. Although I'm certainly not a Holy Roller. My father, although he came from that background, became politicized during the 1930s. Again, not as active, an activist like me. So that was part of it. So I read quite a bit about the Spanish Civil War from 1936 to 1939. And that had a tremendous influence on my life. Then I began to read about the civil rights movement when I was in after Rosa Parks, and even before Rosa Parks, actually. But Rosa Parks was, and I remember going to the radical history, because I was becoming radicalized at the time, and I was very interested, for example, in Paul Robeson and in James Jackson and the Southern Negro Youth Congress in the late 1940s. I was very disturbed that you couldn't find these references in the public library, at least not very many references. Hubert Harrison, I read about the school desegregation efforts and, leading up to Brown versus Board of Education, and even before that. I became interested, and I began to read just different things. I remember reading about Plessy versus Ferguson and really being very upset that I was so stupid, I'm so ignorant, I'm so unknowledgeable about things. So that was the intellectual part, but the activist part. In New York City, there was a very active, progressive life, a progressive left, and there were many African Americans of prominence who set an example, and I, as a young white boy who didn't know anything about anything and just learning, and this is not false modesty, I didn't know, I was enthralled with that. I also remember reading a book called The Puerto Rican in New York by Jesus Colon, who was a self-educated radical person, brilliant man. I know a lot of smart people, but I don't know a lot of brilliant people. He was brilliant, and that had a great influence on me and my interest in Latin America, which continues to this day. Is that sufficient?
Yeah, that's great. Well, tell me about the first social justice action that you ever took.
Boy. I should have known you were going to ask that question. I have an answer for you. Oh, yes, okay. I was 16 years old in 1960. And in February of 1960, was it the first or the second, there was a sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the Woolworths lunch counter. Does Woolworths still exist? I don't even know if it still exists as a chain, but that time it was the biggest chain of what they call five and dime stores in the country. And my father came home from work and said, he told me about this, and I saw it on television or on the paper. And he said, Ira, there's some people who I've just heard about are going to picket our local Woolworths here in New York, in the neighborhood, in support of the people in Greensboro. Would you want to come? And I looked at him, and I was aghast. for some reason, first of all, I had been politicized about 2 or 3 years ago. I was very excited about this. But I was I was skinny. Well, you wouldn't know that now, but I was very skinny then. Don't laugh at me. I hope it doesn't happen to you if it happened to me. But, and I was very nearsighted, which I still am, and I felt very inferior, and I had pimples, and I didn't feel good about myself. And I was scared to death that if I took off from school and went on a demonstration, and God forbid there was a television camera there, and they found out, I would be in trouble in school, and I would also be made fun of by other children. But I thought about it. I didn't have a lot of time to think about it, but I thought about it. I said, yes, Daddy, I'm going to go. So he took off work. Well, maybe he was not working at the time, because my father was unemployed a lot. But anyway, he and I was so proud to go with Daddy. We went on this demonstration, and most of the people that were working-class Jews, it was a multi-ethnic group, but Muslim, and very few people crossed the picket line, as I remember. And there may have been something before that, but that was, for me, the sort of the impelling event that there was no turning back after that.
That's interesting. Well, moving ahead a little bit, sure, to talk specifically about the Kentucky Alliance. So you came to Louisville and you're working with Ann and Carl.
Yes.
So it's through that work, I suppose, that you learned about the Kentucky Alliance. How did you get involved with the organization?
Okay. Well, I need to give you some prefatory information, if I may. There was a big dispute within SCEF in the early 1970s. It resulted in an eventual split in the organization. It was very unfortunate. And Carl and I took different, and Ann and I took different stands. They took, right, and the details aren't important. But it was a very hurtful time for all of us. And in fact, years later, I had a very interesting discussion with Ann. I don't think it was ever tape recorded, but I wrote about it once. And she said to me, Ira, she said, you know, neither of us is going to remember what that split was all about, number one, she says. And probably the FBI took a legitimate difference that people had and exacerbated it to the point where it became a split. They got us fighting each other. And in fact, Carl named to me who he felt was the FBI agent. And I think I agree with him, but I don't like to say anything like that without knowing. In any event, this is important for the Kentucky Alliance. Soon after that, so there was this schism. But Ann and I got together soon thereafter because the schism was around 1972 or 73, I'm guessing. But soon thereafter, there was this busing crisis in Louisville. I have four children, but I only had two at that time, and they both were in school. They were very young. And there was a boycott by white parents, many white parents, of the school system to protest the school desegregation over. And I, of course, sent my children through the picket line to school. And was scared to death. I remember having a hammer, which I put in a paper bag to take with me, because that's how scared I was that there was going to be violence against my children. But anyhow, Ann and I got back together. Soon after that, I don't remember what year, there was a national, and actually an international movement, to free Angela Davis. Angela Davis was arrested and framed. It's a long story. It concerns the Black Panther Party in California, but other things as well. And there was a national organization to free Angela Davis. I was peripherally involved in that, not very, but I was involved. When Angela Davis finally got her freedom, the people who ran the organization helped it transmogrify into the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. So that was the sort of the logical extension, rather than just fold up this tremendous entity with mailing lists that formed. And I was very interested, but because of the friction that had happened in SCEF, I was only peripherally involved in that. I participated in meetings and demonstrations, but I was also very busy in many other activities. It was not like I was just sitting home. But Ann and I began to work very closely together around, I'm guessing, the end of the 1980s. And we did a lot of work in the Kentucky Alliance together. In fact, there were problems with staff and all, and Ann wanted me to train the personnel. I remember a woman named Shamika Parrish, now Shemika Parrish, right? Shemika Parrish came to town, and I helped orient her, and other people were involved in the staff. So that's how I got involved.
What did you hope to achieve through working with the Alliance?
I want an alliance against racist and political repression. Those are the two. If there's such a thing as two Achilles heels, those are the two Achilles heels preventing unity among progressive people. Racism now, as it was in the past. And this is not to denigrate other problems like sexism and homophobia and handicap discrimination, age. But race seems to have been this Achilles heel, this tremendous weakness. Now, W.E.B. Du Bois once said that the problem of the 20th century is a problem of the color line. I think that the problem of the 21st century is the same. I don't think it has changed. And again, this is not to say that other forms of ruling class division are unimportant. They are very important. But race is a key.
In the years that you've been involved with the Alliance, what are some of the major issues that you've organized around?
It's funny, there are so many issues like I can't think of one. We dealt a lot around the school situation, prisons, the fact that I think it's today, but it probably isn't the same as before. Something like 60% of prisoners who are released from the state of Kentucky jails have no place to go. The number of prisoners who are effectively functionally illiterate is very high. So there's no possibility that these people are not going to get in trouble again, because there's no jobs, there's no housing, there's no references. An employer is not going to hire somebody without some sort of a track record or a way to deal. So dealt with that. My particular interest with the Alliance has been around discrimination cases, people who have been discriminated on the job, in hiring, in promotion, retention, etc. Mostly around race, but also dealing with the issue of sex, age, handicap, sexual orientation. So I've done that for a long, long time. I volunteer my time. I help. I'm not a lawyer. I can't practice law without a license, but I have a lot of experience dealing with this. I'm a former commissioner of the Metro Louisville Human Relations Commission. Well, I'm a commissioner now with it, but I was with the old Louisville and Jefferson County Human Relations Commission for 6 years. And we can talk about that later if you'd like. And I had the dubious distinction of having been thrown off the commission twice for a vigorous defense of affirmative action. And so I had experience in doing that. Lately, there have not been many cases because the climate is so bad that people don't file and they can't get. There's no work to be gotten. But it's still out there, and we still get cases. But that's been a main area. More recently, and actually now, right, currently, I'm very involved in the issue of school desegregation, the search for the new school superintendent and all, both as a member of the Kentucky Alliance, but also as an appointee by the mayor, as a commissioner of the Metro Louisville Human Relations Commission.
And for, you know, people listening to this interview 20 years from now, can you kind of talk about what's going on, how this superintendent search came to fruition?
Sure. I can't do that without giving you a little of the history for the last 25 years, because it's all a piece ever. In 1975, a federal judge, James Gordon, who interestingly enough was a real right-wing SOB kind of a judge — some people resisted the war in Vietnam would automatically get 5 years in the slammer from him. He was not progressive. But he made a very progressive ruling around school desegregation in Louisville. I don't think he did it because he was progressive, but because he saw the light. I think judges don't like to be reversed. That's the biggest thing. It's like talking about somebody's mama if your judge gets reversed. And he did the right thing. He ordered schools to be integrated. There were very serious problems with school desegregation at that time. First of all, the plan was not, I don't know what the word is, equitable or not fair to everybody. My children, white children, were bused 2 out of 12 years. African-American kids, who were the victims of this Jim Crow system, were bused 10 out of 12 years. It was disproportionate. Nonetheless, the plan had many effective parts to it. And the example that I like to use is Central High School. Central High School being the traditional African-American school in Jefferson County, Louisville. It had no track. It had few, if any, I don't even know if it had any microscopes in the biology laboratory. Well, when school desegregation was ordered by James Gordon, the first group of students to be bused from a white area to an African-American at the West End was a group from Douglas Hills, Douglas Hills being a very affluent white area. And they were going to be bused to Central High School. Well, all of a sudden, the heavens open up and there's brand new microscopes. There's brand new textbooks. African-American kids hardly ever got new textbooks. They would get the leavings. All of a sudden, there was a new track at Central High School. So anybody tells me that that's separate but equal is equal, doesn't know what the hell they're talking about. They have no sense of reality. Now, one can talk about these problems that exist, like I just mentioned, the disproportionality of sacrifice that's made. But to say, and another thing, of course, is what happened to African-American teachers, the dispersal and the lack of role model. I mean, there are many negative things about them, but I saw some very positive things and still do. Well, come to now, the year, what are we in, 2011 now, and a search for a new school superintendent. The last school superintendent, Berman, I don't think was an evil guy. I think he wanted to do good. He just came from an affluent, small, mostly white suburban area, and he was not cognizant. He didn't know how you deal with a large, multiracial, multiethnic population. For gosh sakes, we've got a burgeoning Latino population in this city that we never had before. You go to the old white areas around Preston Highway, the redneck areas, where now you got tapatias and, you know, restaurantes and all kinds of Latino businesses there now. Well, so he's left, and now they're hiring two new, well, they're interviewing as finalists two new superintendents, superintendent candidates, both females, both eminently well qualified, judging from their CVs. They've got all the credentials. They got the PhDs and actually, you know, they used to say that BS, MS, and PhD means bullshit, more shit than piled higher and deeper. But that's another story. And they had seemingly what it takes to be superintendent. And I can't say that they'll be bad superintendents. However, when you dig down, one of the women, the one who's from lives in Michigan now, when she was in Baltimore, the Baltimore NAACP has given her a very bad grade. They said she was not intelligent or perspicacious, but she was not effective in dealing with a multiracial situation. The other applicant, the other finalist from North Carolina, was the school superintendent, as I understand it, in Wake County, North Carolina, during the time of a school desegregation crisis and a change. And it's not that she did anything bad, but she was not really involved in the process. She was almost peripheral, again, according to people who I know in the area. Well, what do you do about this? As a minor city appointee, that's all I am, with the commission, I was part of a discussion process. We met with the Board of Education, and then we had quite a number of meetings, and we just came out in support of the NAACP position, which didn't say these candidates are no good totally, but said you need to reopen the process to see if we can get more people. I've been involved in discussions in the Kentucky Alliance about the same thing, only on what I consider a higher level and a more politically sophisticated level, more progressive level, although I'm not able to go to all the education meetings in the Kentucky Alliance. I just have too many things on my plate. So that's been my involvement, and even recently, we just issued a statement, the Human Relations Commission did about 4 days ago, 5 days ago, in essence saying reopen the search. And that has created a lot of ripples, because another city entity, the Board of Education, said we've done it. So we're basically in opposition. And as I understand it, the people who run the city are not very happy about what we've done. I'm very proud of what we've done. So that's my involvement.
And so there has been no official response from the mayor's office about the commission's position?
The only thing that Chris Pointer, the spokesperson for the mayor, has said is that the Human Relations Commission is in fact a city entity, but it does not speak for the mayor insofar as his personal view is concerned, which is a very diplomatic way of saying you better watch your behind.
And so what would you like to see the Kentucky Alliance's response to this situation be?
The same as the NAACP, in essence. The NAACP, we don't always agree with everything the NAACP does, but I think that the NAACP has taken a righteous position, and I would like to see the Alliance push for the reopening. It may be a fait accompli, where it may be that it's too late. And Steve Imhoff, who was a personal friend of mine, was the head of the Board of Education, seems rather determined to make the decision within the next little while. The board is either meeting or has met in closed session, because it's a personnel matter, and they're going to decide pretty soon what to do. And I have a feeling that they're either going to choose from one of the two immediately, or they'll reopen the process. They won't delay this any longer. Something has to happen. That's what I see.
Kind of moving back to the Alliance a little bit, sure, and talking about how organizing happens. You mentioned earlier, you talked about the staff. I know that there's a board and committee structure. So can you talk a little bit about how organizing actually happens at the Alliance?
Yeah. Well, the Alliance reflects the progressive movement in the United States. The progressive movement in the United States has faced a lot of turmoil, has faced a lot of flux, and so sometimes there are difficulties in organizing the Alliance, just like there are difficulties in many other organizations. But the Alliance's work on prison reform is very good. Their work on the school desegregation. Now, and then there's no unanimity, incidentally, in the Alliance Committee about how you go about achieving a just school system. So those are the two main areas that the Alliance has worked in. There's a committee against police abuse, CAPA. I don't know what that's doing right now. Again, I'm embarrassed to say that because I've been so busy, I teach at a university and I'm involved in all these things, and I'm very involved around Middle East work, and I write a newspaper column, so I don't have time to do anything. It's the best form of birth control. You know, if I do anything else, I'm busy. Forgive me. I'll bet you edit that out. So you want to know what activities the Alliance is doing besides?
Well, if you can talk about a little bit how the board structure works and how people are elected to the board and how the board makes decisions. I know that there was a time that there was paid staff for the Alliance.
There's no money. There's no money. And it's like this all over the country. It's not just the Alliance. There is no money. And so we constantly face a crisis. We've also faced a crisis, unfortunately, in the progressive movement, where there are organizations that say that they have fealty to the Alliance, but without mentioning names, have not really done enough to assist the Alliance in its mission. Big money has been given to many other entities, fairness, etc., but almost nothing that comes into the alliance. And part of the reason for that, I think, is that there's a criticism, some of which is correct, that the alliance oftentimes is in either in disarray or there's an anarchic situation of people desperate to try to resolve things, but there's no money and there's no staff to do it, and so people are accused of being ineffective. It sounds like I'm giving you something which is tangential, but no, I think this is intrinsic to an analysis of what's going on. The alliance represents in microcosm, Amber, what's happening across the country. People are in deep trouble, and there is indeed a fight back, but the bad guys have learned how to operate in an effective way. And if you like, I can give you some examples of that, but this is sort of going off the topic. But I used to chair the anti-discrimination panel of the old Louisville and Jefferson County Human Relations Commission from 1980 to 1986. I was the vice chair. And we would hear discrimination complaints. The process was as follows, and I think this is the same with the federal government, the EEOC and the OCR and the State Commission on Human Rights and other state commissions across the country, and metropolitan commissions also. So, Amber Duke files a discrimination complaint against the Ira Gruper Manufacturing Company, claiming that there was an unwanted sexual advance made, or that there was a racial discrimination situation. So, you come into the commission, and the commission has what they call an intake officer, and he or she determines whether or not you have jurisdiction here, or whether we have jurisdiction, meaning did Amber file her complaint in the proper amount of time. Some complaints you have a 6-month limit, others have different. And if you file it in 7 months instead of 6 months, even if you're right, you're just SOL, as they say. And then we determine, and do we have jurisdiction, meaning did this alleged discrimination occur in Jefferson County? Okay, let's assume that those things are met. Then it's given off to an investigator. The investigator takes Amber's statement, it's usually a notarized statement that you give, where you say that Joe Smith at the Ira Gruper Company, or maybe Ira Gruper himself, made an unwanted sexual advance, created a hostile work atmosphere, etc. You take that statement and you come to the company, and I or my lawyer or somebody says to you, "Oh no, we love black people, we love women, we would never do anything like that," and we would summarily dismiss it. What really happened was that Amber just couldn't do her job, or for whatever reason she has some sort of problem, maybe with her boyfriend or her husband or somebody, and she's just come and taking it out here. Well, this is just baloney. And then you go back to Amber. Again, this is theoretical, right? And Amber says, "No, and I'll show you." And then you have this witness. And this information, again, in the old commission in the 80s, would then go to the investigator in consultation with what was called the compliance supervisor, then supervising the investigators, would make a determination, a preliminary determination, that there's, in the technical terms, either there's probable cause to believe that Amber was discriminated against, or there's no probable cause. Then that's taken to a board of commissioners, and they either affirm the supervisor's recommendation or they rule against that. If they rule against Amber, then Amber is just out of luck as far as this commission is concerned. You can take this case to a private attorney, but the vast majority of people have no money to go to a private attorney, so you're out of luck. We rule in Amber's favor that there's probable cause to believe, then the commission tries to effectuate what's called a conciliation agreement. A conciliation agreement means that the company and Amber agreed to certain terms, that you'll be put back on the job, You'll be given back pay or partial back pay. You'll be given a promise that there won't be any harassment. And if you file what's called a pattern of practice, in the court they call that a class action, but in this thing, pattern of practice, that they won't do this. Okay, that's what the theory is. Let me tell you what the real world is. It's all bullshit. This is all, it sounds good. Okay, I make an unwanted sexual advance toward Amber Duke. And she repels that advance. Get out of my face. In the old days, I say, bitch, you're fired. Now I don't say that anymore. I say, Ms. Duke, we'd like to retain you in employment, but you have not met our criteria for advancement. And instead of me saying that to you, I'll get a black female supervisor to say to you, that to you. You think this is crazy that I'm making this up? Happens all the time. And how do you then demonstrate a prima facie case of this? Well, there are many ways to do it, but you have to be aggressive. Then let's assume that the case gets up to a situation, and as I understand, I'm not on the enforcement panel of the commission any longer. This is the new commission now. But I chair the other panel. But let's assume that a conciliation agreement is worked upon. Now we found in your favor. The company is basically saying, okay, we'll give this woman back pay, we'll give her back seniority, we'll give her some vacation benefits, we'll promise not to mess with her in the future. We'll even put in a hiring plan to hire more African Americans or women or whomever classes. But we don't admit nothing. We have done nothing wrong. And you can't take my behind to court. No civil damages, sucker. You're out of luck. Why am I giving you all these details? I'm giving you all these details by way to say that the system has learned how to adapt to changed circumstances. This is not to say or imply, or to imply that racism and sexism and homophobia and ageism and handicap discrimination isn't sometimes and oftentimes blatant. But it's more often lately less blatant, more subtle, more sophisticated. And I, as a member of the Kentucky Alliance, want to just rip this sheet off this new facade. The Klan's still wearing a sheet, except the sheet is not as readily apparent. So that's the work that I'm very interested in doing, and I would like to see the Alliance do this more, because we would be more aggressive, more assiduous in our pursuit. Of course, we have no imprimatur of enforcement. We're not a city or a county agency. But this is what needs to be done, I think, in the near future. And it's not being done often enough, and this is not just here, it's across the country. So that's where I am.
How would you summarize the mission of the Alliance and the goals of the Alliance?
I don't remember the wording. I don't remember anything anymore. But we want to bring about a just society. We feel that racism is a main division that keeps working people apart. And we want to deal effectively with the issue of racism. When the National Alliance became the Angela Davis Committee became the National Alliance, it was called the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. I think that it needs to return to that mission, and it hasn't. There is a tremendous amount of political repression in the country today. It is increasing. And I don't think the Alliance either knows enough, or if it does know, it's not active enough around the issue of combining racism and racist and political repression. I would like to see that happen more. I think there's more and more need for that. There have been many cases recently of people being arrested by the FBI and subpoenaed in Chicago recently, in Minneapolis, for anti-war activities in support of justice for the Palestinians, for other nationalities in other countries. And I would like to see the Alliance get involved in that as well. And I don't see that now. But again, Amber, it's a lot of it is money. There ain't no money. And that's the problem.
Can you describe the relationship of the Alliance to other social justice organizations here in Louisville?
I think there has been generally a good relationship over many years. The Alliance has a dinner every year. And it's the most integrated dinner that I've ever seen in this city. We have anywhere between 400 and 1,200 people come. I think when Cornell West spoke about 7-8 years ago, there must have been about 1,100-1,200 people there. And lately it's been smaller, but it's growing again. I think we have good relations with other organizations. Some organizations feel that we're not as well organized as we should be. There needs to be more. I love your organization, but I think that your organization and Braden's needs to have a more active relationship with the Kentucky Alliance. And I think part of it is that Kate, who I love dearly, but they feel that the Alliance is not, that there's too much turmoil, that they would rather be with, you would not like what I say. I would say more respectable people. You would say with people who are less in turmoil. I think that needs to happen. Unless that happens, we're going to face a lot of difficulties.
And you talked about the fundraising challenges being, something nationally that's, a challenge for groups. But what do you think are the specific fundraising challenges for the Alliance? Do you have ideas on how they can overcome these challenges?
I'm not sure. The basic answer is I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. I do know there has to be more outreach. There must be more work. Because it's not just African Americans who are affected in this city now. It's Latinos, other immigrants who are affected. The women's movement, from what I can see, and I'm a man talking, so maybe I shouldn't. It's not a cohesive, unified entity like it used to be. We used to have the Coalition of Labor Union, where they still exist. We had the National Abortion Rights Action League, various women's organizations, which were very dynamic, and I think that needs to happen again amongst disabled people. And that's a very important element, by the way. You have the Metro Disability Coalition, which is one of the few coalitions in the United States that's led by African Americans, that has strong African American leadership in Louisville, and has very interesting programs. They also have problems, internal problems, with money, with dynamics. But I've never seen the Ann Braden's or even the Kentucky Alliance have an active relationship with the disability rights movement. It needs to happen. So there's a lot of challenges ahead for us. I think that these are some of the things that are necessary. I also think people need to be trained, young people, that they need to understand history. And people don't know it. An example I like to use is I was in another city. I was walking down the street and I heard these two dudes talking, and one guy says, "Hey bro, what's happening?" And he says, the other guy says, "Hey, nothing happened." And then the first guy said, "Man, you ain't shit." And the second guy said, "I know it." And they walked on. Now, I'm not a Freudian. I don't like to parse words, and I don't like to try to just look into what's this. But when they say, "What's happening?" The other guy said, "Nothing happened." There's a lot happening. There's just not a cohesive, unified entity to take these things that are happening and to generate it into a progressive movement context. And then when somebody says, "You ain't shit," well, that's saying, "You're not worthwhile as a human being." We're all worthwhile as human beings. And that has not been inculcated into people. And it's not just a matter of civil rights movement. It's a matter of all people. People do not feel that they're worthwhile. I have four children. They're all grown. I have one, it's a master's degree. He's an engineer. He's delivering packages in a truck now. He can't get work after all those years. It's a crisis. I have another child who's got a master's. She's a high school social studies teacher. Can't get work teaching high school social studies. She's going back for another master's to teach English as a second language. And I'm telling you, I shouldn't say this on tape, but there's a lot of teachers who can't get work who are going back to school to get a degree in English as a second language because they can't get their first job, which means there's not going to be as many openings. This is the crisis that we are facing. We're facing a crisis of unemployment. Another thing that has to be dealt with, since you're asking what does the Alliance or other people deal with? The Alliance is a 501c3 entity, and I think that it needs to somehow bifurcate in a way that the ACLU has done it, where you have one part that's non-profit, the 501c3, and another part that deals with the political stuff. There needs to be an analysis of the Obama administration. The fact that most of the attacks in the Obama administration before, when he was running for president, and even afterward, were nothing but stone racist attacks. On the other hand, he ain't done nothing as far as employment is concerned. The employment situation is getting worse, and I don't care if he's African American or not. If he ain't doing the job, then he needs to be criticized. And I think the Alliance needs to be about the business of making that criticism in a non-antagonistic way. Put it in a point where, as an example, and this is just one person's observation, as somebody who's been in and out of city politics and as well as, and I won an important discrimination case, you should ask me about that, handicap discrimination. No, I'm getting too far off the topic, but go on.
Well, I want to talk about, spend some time talking about multiracial organizing. Okay. I know that the racial makeup of the Alliance has probably fluctuated over the years, but generally, can you describe the racial makeup of the Alliance?
I would say it's always been multiracial.
Okay.
There are times when the white people in the Alliance have, for whatever reason, been more vocal and more public than the African Americans, and that's a serious problem. A problem of objective, not subjective, but objective white paternalism. But there's also been a tremendous thrust toward egalitarianism and toward including everybody in the organization. And I'm very proud of the Alliance for that thrust.
And you talked about the growing Hispanic, Latino population in Louisville. Has the Alliance been able to have any folks from those new communities become a part?
Yes. In fact, we give awards every year at our banquet, and several Latinos have been honored in the last few years. There is a working relationship. Again, given the flux that the Alliance finds itself in and the financial and other difficulties, It's quite difficult to build this. This needs to be worked on more. But there certainly are the seeds that have been planted for that. That's the best way I can answer you. I don't think there's enough work being done, no. But there's that possibility.
Have you made friends while organizing at the Alliance?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about some of the relationships you've developed.
I'll tell you a little about Bob Cunningham. You know Bob Cunningham. We've known each other, I guess, I don't know, 40 years, but we really got to know each other during the school busing crisis. What we decided, that there was an organization formed at that time called PIE, Progress in Education, to counter the racist anti-busing movement. And Bob and I were on the committee. Maybe we were the committee. There were others, but we were on a committee that was going to go out to various white working class areas, not only those, but and try to talk to people who had these tremendous fears what integration was going to do. And so he and I went to way out on Taylor Boulevard and white working class area. We went out to Okolona and to Fairdale and near McNeely Lake and places where we would walk to the car and we would be looking around. We were a little scared. And we talked to him. Bob is just a tremendous, tremendous orator. And he has a way of talking to people that really, well, you're shaking your head like you know him, and so you know this. He gets confidence of people. And so we developed that relationship over many years, and so we've known each other for all these years, and we were involved in many projects together. So that would be one friendship that I value, that I've developed over the years. Other people, there's a woman no longer living named Jackie Shaw, and I had a very good relationship. And then I feel good relationship with the current people who are active in the Kentucky Alliance. It's been a very important aspect. If there's ever any benefits to being involved in the progressive movement, there's a lot of negatives. There's no money. You're not going to move up in the corporate ladder if you are very strongly involved in making trouble and being bad. But these kinds of relationships, Amber, are for me life-sustaining. I have nothing but the highest praise for someone like Bob Cunningham, just to use that example. A man who's maybe 75, 76 years old now, is not in the best of health. And God knows I want him to live to be 100. But it's those kinds of relationships. And you're not going to find, unfortunately, Bob's name in the compendia and indices of the civil rights legends. The civil rights legends are usually people who have their names in the paper, and his name is not always in the paper. But the person who's there to do the kind of work that needs to be done, that's him. So that's an example of the kind of friendships I've developed, and you can't put a monetary value on that.
How has your family life impacted by the time that you've spent, I mean, not just working with the Alliance, but in all of the work that you've done?
Married twice, living with somebody now for 10 years. There's been a lot of turmoil in my life. I'm not saying that there weren't a progressive movement, that wouldn't be the case. It may be my own inadequacies. And maybe it's just the way society is nowadays. People go from partners to partners. But it's made an impact. Particularly my involvement in the labor movement, first trying to be a union organizer and then working within organized labor, and trying to expose the bad things that are going on as far as race and sex, etc. I've had a fight my own colleagues oftentimes, not just fight the bad guys in the corporations. So it's taken a toll. You want to be a union organizer, you take these crazy jobs where you'd be working different shifts, and your life is just... But that's what working people face generally. It's not moving people are no better or worse than working people in general. It takes a toll on you. It's taken a toll on my health. But I would have had it no other way. I'm proud of what I've done. Maybe that sounds arrogant or egotistic, but that's how I feel. I was involved and am involved in the disability rights movement. I mentioned a case that I won, a very important case. And notwithstanding the battle that I fought over it, I've met people. It's just changed my life. It's given me a perspective on things that I didn't have.
Do you want to talk in a little more detail now about that case?
Sure. I'm legally blind. My corrected vision makes me legally blind. I'm partially sighted. I can read a paper and all, but you couldn't tell the nature of my disability unless you saw me bend something up to my nose to read. And when I became politicized and I became union-centric, if you will. You know, have to be a union organizer or involved where there's an organized place and try to democratize it. Well, to get hired on a place, you have to take a physical. And what I would do is I would sneak into a medical office in a factory or a warehouse or what have you and memorize the eye chart because I had a very retentive memory. Well, I can't remember anything anymore. I can't tell you what I ate for breakfast today. If that didn't work, for whatever reason, I'd have somebody of a similar height and weight build to me, take the test for me. And if that didn't work, I would pay somebody off. Am I proud of these things? No. But that's the real world. They didn't hire people with disabilities. Finally, around 1970 or 71, I guess it was, I said to myself, Ira, you're a big idiot. Well, I've said that to myself before. I said, hey, you are fighting for everybody else and you're not fighting for yourself. What's wrong with you? So I bought me a book, Amber, for $2.50, or whatever, how to do legal research. I was very skilled, if I may say that without sounding immodest, in doing research in general, because I did a lot of that when I was in SNCC in Georgia, where I moved to Mississippi. I had a lot of experience in doing research, but I had no experience in doing legal research. So I bought this book, and I went to the University of Louisville Law Library, because I had no money. And I pored over the books, and I finally found this law called the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, Public Law 93.112, Subdivision 4A4. You know, I knew all this stuff. And then there was a Section 503 and 504, which were very relevant. 503 says that any company that does business as a federal, with the federal government, as a contractor or a subcontractor, meaning if I own a construction company and you sell me paper clips, you fall under the aegis of the laws or your subcontractor. Any company that does business with the federal government cannot discriminate against a person with a disability and further has to make what's called reasonable accommodation to conform to the parameters of the disability. Reasonable accommodation being a particularized form of affirmative action, which is what African Americans were fighting for. And an example of that is if you're sitting in a wheelchair and you got to go to the bathroom, they got to widen the stall so you can get in there. Or if you're deaf and you're working around fast-moving equipment, and then equipment starts up automatically and a buzzer rings to warn you not to put your hand in it, well, obviously a deaf person can't. So there needs to be either a light bulb that goes off or maybe the machine needs to start manually. I don't know. So armed with this information about this Rehabilitation Act of 1973, I go down to the State Employment Service, 6th and Cedar downtown, and I take this, I think they call it a GATB test, G-A-T-B. It's a manual dexterity test where you put the square pegs in the square holes and the round ones. And I evidently pass the test because I get a call from Philip Morris about 3 weeks after. This is 1975, July of 75. Said, well, we need you to come down and take the physical now. And you can't have the first shift or the second shift because you don't have enough seniority. You might start there, but you won't wind up there. And then we need you to fill out the Blue Cross forms, the medical insurance forms, Blue Cross Blue Shield. So for me, the unspoken assumption was that I was being hired contingent upon passing this physical. This is July of 75. I take the physical, didn't pass it. That was on a Friday. The following Monday, I call up Philip Morris. And you know, Philip Morris was considered a very liberal company. And I asked for the medical department. I said, a nurse, I understand I didn't pass this test. Can you tell me why? She was very strong, supposed to be on hold. And she said, comes back 5 minutes later. She said, well, I just spoke with the doctor. And the doctor said, we can't hire anybody with vision as bad as yours is. Isn't that bad? Thank you very much. And I hung up, except I wasn't on the phone by myself. I had an attorney and also a representative from the Kentucky Council of Blind, part of the American Council of Blind. So I filed my discrimination complaint under this Rehabilitation Act of 1973 that I had researched. And incidentally, that law eventually became superseded by another law called the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. But this was prior to that, so I was sort of a pioneer, if I could say that, being immodest. So I file a complaint. It took these bastards 6 months, and finally, and the U.S. Department of Labor, OFCCP, Office of Federal Contract Compliance Program in Atlanta, were the ones who oversaw the complaint. And they didn't do anything, or more appropriately, they didn't do nothing. And so by that time, I was getting different organizations to help me. And Wendell Ford, used to be called the senator from tobacco, Philip Morris pissed him off, or the Department of Labor pissed him off, because he wrote a letter on my behalf, and he never got an answer. You know, not answer. I don't mean him personally, but one of his, mm-hmm. his slaves did that. His minister. 6 months later, the company called the Department of Labor, who then called my attorney. They wouldn't speak to me directly. They thought I was a hothead. I suppose I was, but that's the kind of paternalism. I said, okay, we admit having discriminated against Ira Grouper, that we didn't hire him. We discriminated. I'm sorry. We'll give him 6 weeks back pay, but we cannot hire him because in a routine employment check, we discovered that he had lied on his employment application. He said that he's shaking your head, this is what happened. He said that he was a satisfactory employee, and in fact, he was not. So had we hired him, it would have taken us about 6 weeks to discover that he was fabricating this, and since we didn't hire him, we'll give him this money. Well, my mama didn't raise no fool. I might be dumb, but I ain't stupid. And I had no idea that they would do this. But in anticipation of anything they did, I went to all my past employers and got letters of recommendation. And I got a letter from my previous employer, which I think was Fawcett Haynes Printing Company, 11th and Broadway, big, huge company, that they moved out of the city and they laid people off, and that was no fault of my own. So that set up a scenario. Either Philip Morris was lying or I was lying. There was no gray area. There was no gradation, no nuance. Well, finally, the Department of Labor issued what they call a letter of determination saying that I was discriminated against and encouraging the parties to sit down to effectuate a conciliation agreement. Well, it was all bullshit. I wanted to conciliate. I wanted to work. I wasn't... At that time, I was separated. I had young kids at home. I had no money. I was living on food stamps, living in an apartment. And I had no money. I mean, I was busted. It takes another year. Finally, by that time I had, I think, 15 lawyers representing about 12 or 13 organizations. This was not a I don't know that you could look up my name in an index and find this case that way. It was not like that. But many organizations, particularly the American Council of the Blind, was pushing it, thought that this would be a precedent-setting case. Finally, my lawyer, I had a chief lawyer in Washington, but the local lawyer calls me, he says, you won, they're going to hire you in 2 weeks. I said, well, What are they giving me? He says, they're giving you a damn job. I said, I'm not accepting it. He says, you what? And this was a corporate type lawyer, a very nice guy, and he had never met anybody like me before. A guy who comes in there with a nasty work uniform to his fancy office. That I didn't do it deliberately, but I had a part time job at the time, and I use all these polysyllabic words with the proper syntax. I didn't say fuck. I said, well, I'm not accepting it. He says, you what? I said, well, first of all, what's this? And he never even thought it. I said, what's to stop them from working me for 2 weeks and saying, we love handicapped people, but Ira couldn't do the job, so we just had to let him go. Sorry. He said, besides which, he said, I want back pay. I want back seniority. I want back vacations. I want all the chances that I could have bid on a higher job, because it's a union situation. I want that to be, I want to be able to avail myself of that. I want the company to pay my union initiation fee, which is a lot of money. I want to promise that they're not going to harass me anymore. I promise that they're not going to retaliate against me. I can't remember now all the other things that I asked for. So, I could just see him scratching his head. And the other lawyers, they confirmed, of course, he was not just one. Well, the agreement was that I would go to work at what they called them on a trial work period as opposed to being a probationary employee. The terminology was used so that they could differentiate that from the union process. The union was rather sympathetic to me, but they didn't want to abdicate the hierarchical nature of it. If I lasted 30 days, well, if they thought I couldn't do the job after, let's say, a week or two, and they were adamant about it, a third-party intermediary, which I would have input in selecting, an expert on rehabilitation therapy or industrial designs, would make the final determination of whether I could do the job or not. If I lasted the 30 days, I would receive, I would get the job, I'd get full seniority, partial back pay. They owed me then about $19,000 or $23,000. They only offered me six. I would have to have accepted that. This is an aside, but my attorney told me that I could have gotten the whole thing if I were willing to fight longer, but I had no money. I was absolutely broke. I promised that they wouldn't harass me and blah, blah. Well, I worked there 24 years, so I must have been at least minimally satisfactory. It was my experience in the civil rights movement that steeled me for this fight. I would not have had that because I was always feeling inferior about myself and all, but the civil rights movement helped me. There are many other things to this fight. For example, I can say this now, I'm retired, and I don't think I do. My whole resume was all a bunch of lies. Except for the part about that they challenged. I had to say that I was never arrested. I was arrested in the civil rights war, both sides of the Mason-Dixon line, etc. But having won that case, many things happened. First of all, Philip Morris, are you from Louisville?
New Albany.
New Albany, okay, so you know this area. Mm-hmm. Philip Morris was one of the prize jobs you could get. When I left Philip Morris in 1999, June of 1999, the lowest paid worker, once he or she got into the union, was making almost $22 an hour. The lowest paid worker. So when people got hired there, they thought they died and went to heaven. This was a prized job. But I forgot my point. What were you asking me last? What was I saying last? Well, let me just say a lot of things came my way as a result of having won this case. Oh, I don't know. It takes a long time to establish a rapport if you're going to be an organizer. This was not a non-union, it was a union place, but still, we wanted to democratize the union, a bunch of us. You got to drink a lot of beer. You go to a lot of bowling alleys, you know, what happened. When I got hired at Philip Morris, I started in 77. Again, I got back seniority from about February 77. To meet people. It was a city. The building was from 18th and 19th, and they built another extension. It was almost two blocks long, maybe a block wide, seven stories tall. That's the main building. There are other buildings, too. There's a stemmery out of Miller's Lane. Everybody knew that this handicapped, cockeyed freak was coming to work. I didn't have to drink a lot of beer. Everybody, people were really wonderful to me. And again, this is all because of my understanding of the civil rights movement, what I learned how to fight. And I remember the first day I went to work, and they put me on day shift because they were watching me, and they had, oh my God, they had time study people, and they had the head of... is this helpful to you, we give you this? Okay. Watching me every time I scratch somebody, be right. Right there. And then a woman comes up to me. It's the first day. She says, give me your name and your phone number. And I'm looking at her. Very attractive woman. I said, well, may I ask why? She says, well, you can't be late for work for the first 30 days. You can't be late. You can't be absent. They'll fire you. And I'm going to call you every morning to make sure you get up. And I started to cry. The next day, she and another woman come up to me. She says, and again, I'm on day shift at the time. I didn't have the seniority to stand there, but because I was being watched. I said, when you get off, the shift was from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. When you get off, we want you to come upstairs. They gave me a particular floor to go to, a particular department. And I said, why? She said, well, we're going to set up a little assembly line for you. What you can't see, with I'm going to show you how to do it with your hands. Uh-huh. And I'll never forget that as long as I live. Now, once I did my job, and I showed that I could do the job, a lot of things came my way. It's nice to be nice to the disabled. We don't riot like black people. We don't burn our bras like the women. We're just palpably in need of goods and services and paternalism. But that's the stereotypic paternalistic view that people have. And so the mayor's office called me like 2 years into my tenure. It was then William Sandsberg was the mayor. He didn't call me personally. We would like to appoint you to the Human Relations Commission as a commissioner. I didn't solicit. Was offered it. And I didn't know what to do. I said, well, I'll get back with you, thank you. So I called my progressive friends on the left, and actually the Alliance, and then was it the Alliance then, I guess it was, and other groups. And they all said to me, you're just such an egotistic, arrogant little bastard. They said, what good is that hanging out with all these bourgeois people? You're just going to feel good about yourself and with all this pomp and circumstance. And what does it mean? It means nothing. Stay involved. And Ann Braden calls me up. And did you know her? Had you met her? Well, Ann Braden was a very direct person. God bless her. She says, Ira, you're a damn fool. I want to see you. And so I went to see her. She says, now you know the reason that they're hiring you. I mean, the reason they're going to appoint you to this commission is because you're this little freak. Who? It's really nice to be nice to the disabled. Again, we don't burn the bras. What the hell do you care why they hired you? How often does a progressive person get to sit on a commission like that? Accept it. And so I was telling her about my left friends. She says, see, left friend is bullshit. Just do it. She says, but you got to do one thing for me. I said, what's it? She says, you are known to have a really big mouth. She says, you need to shut up for a year and learn how the system works. You need to do that. She says, you're a veteran of the civil rights movement. She says, use your knowledge that you've acquired over the years and your union, use that knowledge to figure out how to help people. Being in that, and she says, never be awed by those people. They put their underwear on one leg at a time, just like you. So Amber, I said, okay. And I remember showing up at the commission. Now, by that time, I was on the day shift. I think, yeah, I was on day shift by that time. And I got off work at 3 o'clock. And the meeting started at like 3:30, because I don't drive a car, I had no time. I was living in Old Louisville at the time. I had no time to go home and to take a shower and to change into a suit and tie. So I would show up at these meetings. And here are all these women and men very fancily dressed, the women in their Calvin Klein outfits and the men in their Armani suits. I don't know if they were Armani suits at that time, but they were Armani suits, and Brooks Brothers suits, and the silk ties, and you know. And here I am with this gray work uniform coming in there with heavy work boots with steel toes. And I stank to high heaven from the tobacco dust and all this that was in my hair, and I just didn't have, I don't like to do that, but that's what I did. And they would look at me, and you could see, I don't know if the word is disdain, but you could see that I was not good enough for some of these fuckers. Excuse my language. But then I'd open my mouth, and I'd use every polysyllabic sesquipedalian word that I knew, you know, and I was well prepared for each word. Most of them were not. And they were very impressed. You know, here was this freak who uses all these big words and could quote from Molière and the Du Bois and whoever else. And so I was appointed. Let's see. I got appointed to the Anti-Discrimination Panel, which ruled on allegations of discrimination here, public accommodation, housing, and employment, based on race, sex, age, and disability, no, sexual orientation at that time. Well, at that time they called it sexual preference, but there was no ruling, no coverage at that time. And they were very impressed with me. And so I became the chair of that commission, of that panel, and I was elected by the other commissioners, was I appointed, elected to be the vice chair of the commission proper. So that's pretty high up for not being there a year. And I realized I was never going to become chair because the chair is usually somebody who is either a heavy contributor to the Democratic Party or somebody who's better politically connected than I was or ever will be. At that particular time, Clarence Thomas had been appointed by Ronald Reagan to head the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And you know about Clarence Thomas. Okay. He set about, son of a bitch, to dismantle all the gains that were made during the Civil Rights Movement, all the mechanisms of protecting people against discrimination in the EEOC, the most important of the agencies, the lead agency, he was dismantling. And of course, he was later rewarded by being put on the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the Human Relations Commission is what's called a 706 deferral agency, which means that if you file a complaint with the local Metro Human Relations Commission, it's like you're filing with the federal government or with the state. They're supposed to have it either. So I had, in essence, a relationship to the EEOC. I had a vested interest in what Clarence Thomas was. He was not just a bad guy doing bad things. He was fucking with my agency. Well, the year was about up for my in-brains order for me to be a good boy. And I exposed what was going on, not just with him, but in the EEOC. But what was happening locally with the lack of enforcement, the lack of assiduousness in pursuing discrimination complaints with the desire to really change the climate. Now, the city people, they got really pissed at me, the commission, because they realized that I really was no good. I was not just a little freak who uses the big words, but that there was something wrong with me. And you serve at the pleasure of the appointing authorities. Oh, and then they could also say, they could say that I was a hothead and that I was inappropriate in my expose and my remarks, but they couldn't say that I was uninformed. They couldn't say that I was stupid. They couldn't say that I didn't know about the process. I fucking chaired the process. So when my appointment was up, it was a 2-year appointment, they wouldn't reappoint me. A coalition formed of just about every progressive group in the city, and I have, if you're ever interested, I'll show you the article I saved them. Betty Baillet was then a reporter for the Louisville Times, the Courier Journal, and Clarence Matthews for the Louisville Times, and they wrote extensively about this fight that I had. Anyhow, a coalition formed just about every disability rights group and women's group and civil rights group got together, and they forced the city to reappoint me.
Well, about what year was that?
I'm guessing about 82 or 83. It was a tremendous victory. So I went about continuing to do what I did. At that time, Joseph McMillan, who's no longer living and who was my dear friend, he was on the commission also. And at one point, and he also was thrown off the commission, put off the commission, by the way, at a different stage. He was the chairman of the Human Relations Commission at one point. I was the vice chair. I chaired this anti-discrimination panel that ruled on discrimination complaints, and he was a member of my panel. So we were, you'll forgive the vernacular, we were kicking ass and taking names. We were enforcing the law. We were not, if you had a discrimination complaint and you couldn't prove it, we'd rule against you. We're not foolish, we're not interested in just making a statement. But if you could prove, it's called a prima facie case of discrimination, we go after those bastards. Well, my time expired. Well, he was not reappointed. He then went to the State Commission. But anyway, that's another story. And my second term came up, and they wouldn't reappoint me. And what I learned was that the commission went to my union, and my union at that point didn't like me either, because I was a leader of a rank-and-file caucus within the union, and I had run for union office at home. They thought I was a hothead, which I was. And they asked my union if there was an African-American union official who they could appoint in my place. That's verbatim. Maddie Jones, who was very active in the progressive movement, she found out, and she was one of the leaders of this fight to get me back the second time. But they did find somebody, an African-American person, to take that place. And I must say, regretfully, Lyman Johnson, who by that time was beginning to lose it, they put him in his chair of the panel that ruled on discrimination complaints. And he was not cognizant, really, of the fight that was being waged. I mean, I don't hold anything against Lyman. But how was I, a young white boy, going to go up against a civil rights legend? They used it, so I didn't get appointed the second to my third term. All this is by way of saying that were it not for me being steeled in the civil rights movement, my knowledge, I was an active first in SNCC and then in COFO, the Confederate Organizations in Mississippi, and then the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. I was the project director for one of those things. And then having met Ann and Carl and many other fine people, I had long talks with a fellow named Jack O'Dell, very important person in the civil rights movement, now lives in Canada. He's in his 80s. Were it not for that, I don't think that my life would have taken the turns that it did. So it was the civil rights movement that impelled me to be involved in other areas.
We could talk for hours and days about all the amazing things that you've experienced and gone through, but as we come to a close, at least this time, we may need to talk again. Is there anything that you'd like to share that you haven't had the opportunity to yet today?
Well, so many things. I've been to the Middle East 5 times. I lived there for 6 months on a grant once, and I have a lot to say about that, about justice in general, about the need to link issues. But I would say that a lesson that I've learned, Amber, is that you don't get anything without fighting for it, and you don't keep anything unless you continue to fight for it. Or more appropriately, you don't get nothing without fighting for it. You don't keep nothing unless you continue to fight for it. And we see that every day. We see many of the gains that were won being taken away. We see, you know, that saying, men lead lives of quiet desperation. There is quiet desperation right now. You have a master's degree. Are you assured of a job someplace? Do you think you're going to make big money necessarily? Okay. What do you do about it? Unless you build a cohesive, unified, I told you about my children, I tell you about all my kids. And, maybe I should have even said that on the tape, I don't know. My kids, they're all having difficulties. all of them. That's what I would say. The lesson for me is that you must continue to fight. You must continue to build organizationally. And the other thing is that Anne Braden once said, there's no enemies on the left. I think she was a little naive and such a blanket statement, but her point generally is very correct. That we as people on the left have to get together to bring about change. The examples that I've given you and then what little I know about these proves that point again and again. By yourself, you're nothing. You'll get nowhere. They'll kick your teeth in every time. But if we get together, we'll make it. And I'm very optimistic about the future. I'm not optimistic about the immediate present. I'm a little depressed. The irony is that I, who am not highly educated in terms of degrees, I'm self-educated, have earned a better income in many ways than my children may experience. I know many people whose kids are moving back in with them because they cannot make it out there. These are not stupid kids. Can't make it. So that's what I would say to you. And I think that these kinds of interviews are very important. I just hope that they don't gather dust. That they use, not that I'm so important, but the interviews with many other people that you've done. I've seen too much gather dust. I teach two classes at Bellarmine, one on the history of the U.S. Civil Rights Movement and one on the Israeli-Palestinian impasse. And I can make no assumption of a priori knowledge on the part of these students. These are not stupid students. These are not, for the most part, these are not kids who have to work and go to school at night. Some of them do. It costs $36,000 a year to go to that school, room and board, books and tuition. There are students on scholarship, there are poor students. But they don't know nothing. Can you believe that I was told by one professor when I first got hired? I said, what do they know about the Middle East? He says, bring in a map and show them where the Middle East is. And I said, you must be joshing me. No, so I said, you got to be shitting me, man. And about the Civil Rights Movement? No, that's a whole other discussion. Students are black and white. No, almost nothing. So, that's our job. That's your job. You're younger than me.
Thank you so much.
I'm happy to do it.